And I would say, coming back to your question on what makes it so hard to lead consistently well, I would say that one factor is that we don't take enough time to honestly answer these three questions.
And please regard this as an initial salary in the truest sense of the word. It'll grow with your results, unquote. Dear Werner, these are words in the cover letter of my first employment contract. It was signed by an exceptional leader. It was signed by you, an exceptional leader who I have the pleasure to interview today. And this leader is you, Werner. This is Stefan Hohmeister. Hello and welcome to today's Lightwolf podcast entitled Leading to Results. Today's edition is very special. I have the huge pleasure to have a conversation with one of the most highly accomplished global business leaders in the consumer goods world. It's my pleasure to introduce Werner Geisler. Dear Werner, welcome to the Lightwolf podcast.
Thank you, Stefan. It's a privilege.
Werner looks back at a tremendous career in Procter & Gamble over 36 years. He successfully led businesses in Central and Eastern Europe, the Middle East and Africa, in the US, in Turkey, in China, in Japan, and served as Vice Chairman, Global Operations, in charge of all global countries and manufacturing until retirement from P&G in 2015. Werner is now an active investor in several startups covering a broad range of industries. He is a board member at Goodyear, Philip Morris, and member of the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. Werner, you signed my first employment contract in 1990, and you were my boss in the 90s. I know from working with you that you focus on delivering results with a level of consistency I have never seen stronger in any other leader I met. My favorite among the quotes I heard you say is, Stefan, making commitments generates hope. Keeping commitments generates trust. A great expression of your attitude to delivering results. Let's start. Werner, over to you. If you think about leadership, and that is a broad concept, it's complex, and many people have different views on this. What is the essence of good leadership to you, Werner?
Well, first of all, Stefan, as you know, there are millions and gazillions of books, articles, and speeches on leadership. So please don't expect from me any new earth-shattering insights or rules. I can only try to share my own personal experiences and approach to leadership. Ultimately, I would say leadership boils down to enabling other people to achieve results, which without you, they would not be able to achieve, good ones and the bad ones. This implies to set appropriate goals, have the right strategies and action plans in place, and to ensure that the people on your team have the right soft and hard skills and capabilities. And I'm saying bad ones too, because too often we have leaders who claim credit for great results, but attribute bad results to circumstances, incapable employees, or competition. But mostly, leaders are accountable for bad results too, and they should assume responsibility if they want to qualify as good leader. Because as we all know, failure is part of the experiencing and learning process. So that would, in a nutshell, be my definition of essence of good leadership.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you very much, Werner. So it's all about enabling others to deliver great results.
Yeah.
And like you, I've seen some do it well and some take the credit in the sunshine. But there are also sometimes leaders who just try to avoid taking responsibility when the shit hits the fan, when it's raining. Yeah. Yeah, completely agree. Now, I think, as you say, a lot has been said and published about leadership. And it's relatively easy to talk about it and discuss it and say it. But what matters is to do it. In my view, there are four different levels. It's all about doing it at all, then doing it well, then doing it consistently well, and ultimately still doing it consistently well, even under pressure. Now, What makes it so hard to lead consistently well, even under pressure?
It's a very good question. I've been thinking about it a lot. And I would say at the core of it is the inability to lead based on sound, time-proven principles. And in my view, it all starts with clarity about oneself, what Plato, as a Greek philosopher, used to call gnotise auton, know yourself. You have to have a deep understanding of what makes you tick, what your personality is, and how you come across before you can start effectively leading other people. You have to learn to lead yourself. And I have worked hard on identifying my own principles and only succeeded in crystallizing them after many iterations and until I felt comfortable with them in my own skin, and of which people around me would say they are authentic and congruent with how Werner thinks, operates, and behaves. And these principles provide a mental framework and almost as a checklist how to approach leadership issues and questions, be they business or people related. And they make you predictable. Your people don't have to second guess all the time where is one coming from, what's important to you, and how you approach things. So I think you have, in order to have that consistency in leadership, you have to have a good understanding of yourself, and you have to have as a guideline sound and authentic principles. If you want to know mine, I can share them with you. It's very simple, it's pretty straightforward. My principles are cool head, warm heart, working hands. And the cool head is all about facing reality as it is, not like we would like it to be. It's about managing what I call the sigmoid curve or the S curve, understanding where you are on that sigmoid curve, predicting what the changes in the environment will be, and so to prepare for those and create new capabilities before it is too late. Acting and thinking and acting strategically, and asking the right questions. That is what I mean with a cool head. And warm heart is then all the social skills, the empathy, and I'll get back to those points later in the interview. I hope I will have an opportunity to elaborate on them. Then working hands is to deliver results.
Yeah, great. Cool head, warm heart, working hands. Yeah, let's drill deeper. Now, one other question that is often debated and I think is important is, what is the right balance between the what, i.e. the results, and the how of performance, for instance, in culture and in other factors? Now, this is subjective, this is different, and this is very individual. Yeah. But how do you strike that balance, Werner? How do you strike the right balance between the what and the how?
I'm not sure whether balance is the right word in this context, because there isn't or there shouldn't be a trade-off between the what and the how. Certainly not if we are talking about delivering consistently good results over years or even decades. The how, or if you wish, the culture lets you focus on the what. And by how or culture, I'm not talking about the written and codified rules, but also about the intuitive stuff. The true north as to what is acceptable to yourself and to the people who work with you and around you. The words, and very importantly, the unspoken and underlying feelings in the organization. We tend to focus too much on the deeds, less so on the words, and hardly on the feelings. And how certainly touches on my second principle, the warm heart. When you treat your people with respect, when you have empathy for them in their various roles as a professional and as a mother or father, when you care for their development and when you are totally transparent with them as to their performance and potential, and they trust you, and when they trust you, they give their best and they want you to win too. So often we violate the trust of our people by not being really open or treating them inequitably. For example, by mixing up evaluation of the performance for a given period and long-term potential. It then happens, and it has happened in my career. I've done it myself. So I'm victim and Teda, for example, that the so-called high potentials always gets the best annual ratings, even though their numbers aren't the best, and vice versa. And that people know that. Nothing is secret in an organization. And if that happens, it breeds mistrust. My quintessence here is that ultimately, it is more important for leaders to like their people than for their people to like them. And I've always felt strongly about the claim that people don't resign from companies, they resign from their bosses. And lack of off or deteriorating trust is the chief parameter that makes people start contemplating to leave. But beware of howism, as I would call it, where the process is more important than the results, something that I encountered in Japan, where because of the Japanese culture, the process sometimes was more important than delivering results. And I had to educate my people in Japan that the process is only good if the results are great.
Yeah.
And we're also seeing it nowadays, occasionally in today's environment of political correctness. How is more important than the results?
Yeah, I think these are great thoughts. Let me pick on two particularly. The first one, and that really strikes me, is that we should not think of the what and the how as a trade-off. You think about it as inseparably intertwined. There should not be an either or, and I like that thought a lot. I also completely agree with your perspective that people join companies, but people leave their bosses in many instances. It's still, I think it's 68% in the last Gallup research, and still by far the most important reason for talent to leave a company is leadership, including their direct line manager. So you're completely right. You already alluded to this, and we talked about this when we last met in Munich. Your experience in Japan, Werner, this experience in Japan is one that strikes many chords with me regarding leadership, regarding changing a culture, regarding focus, because I recall two things that you focused on. If you could just share with our Lightwolf audience today, what was your experience in Japan when you intervened to literally transform our company's leadership culture to one that won the future?
Stefan, before I answer that question, let me finish on the question before, because I mentioned my three principles, and I think the how and the balance between what and how touches on my third principle, which is working hands, which encompasses insights like every second we either add value or cost. It is as simple as that. It touches on operational discipline and execution as strategic. As my old boss, Herbert Schmitz, who you also may know, used to say, shipments are strategic. And that we're able to deliver short-term results, but also focus on sustainability of results. And so that there is no trade-off. I think they are intrinsically linked, and you have to work on both. Both amplify each other. Now, to your question on Japan, well, it's a long story, I'll try to keep it short. It obviously has to start with deep penetration and understanding of the factors which in the past have generated average or poor results. In this context, I think it's very important that we avoid overreacting to short-term numbers, whether they are good or bad. Most of the time, they're misleading, like snapshots never tell a story, trends do. So when I came to Japan, it was in February of 2001, we looked at a terrible quarter and everyone was getting depressed and desperate. And I said, okay, wait a second, let's look at the longer underlying trends. And so what we saw that was that over the previous 4 years, we had actually performed pretty well. And when I pulled aside the curtain even further, we looked at 10 years trends. But there I discovered that our sales in 2000 had been exactly at the level of where they had been in 1990, so 10 years earlier. And it all been camouflaged and hidden by reporting numbers in dollars. It completely ignored the currency effect. So in real yen terms, our business had been stagnant for 10 years. And so again, trends tell a story, not snapshots. If I had only looked at the last 3 months, I would have, maybe I would have panicked. If I had looked only at the last 4 years, I would have been relaxed. But when looking at the past 10 years, a real, real worrying trend emerged. So I then focused on isolating, first of all, identifying, then isolating and changing a few key factors that had contributed to those underperformance over a whole decade. And I think that in my view, obviously there's some judgment involved, in my view, there were two factors which were key contributors to that underperformance. And the first one was that we had a yo-yo pattern in our performance. Partially because of our structure with the GBUs that more or less independently created their own innovation programs. And so what happened is that initiatives were not synchronized. And because of the Japanese culture to execute a given initiative, for example, superbly well, they lost sight of the rest of the business. And so what we gained in one category, we lost in another, or within a category, what we gained on one brand like Pantene, we lost on Head & Shoulders. So that yo-yo pattern in our performance was quite striking. And the other one was that we clearly had an over-dependence on expats. When I came to Japan, we had over 100 expats. And the issue with that is not only cost, because expats are expensive and, you know, the cost associated with expats take away from the resources needed to invest into the business. But the real issue was that most of these expats are more senior people, and that is where the strategic know-how rests. And so when you come to Japan as an expat, especially U.S. expats, it takes them quite some time to understand and survive and then thrive in a culture which is alien to most Americans. And then after 2 or 3 years, they leave, and all the strategic know-how leaves with them as well. And so we had clearly not put adequate resources against developing local talents. So I identified and isolated these two factors as key contributors to the underperformance of the country. And so what we did is we worked with the GBUs to synchronize initiatives much better across categories and within categories. So for example, when we had a product initiative on Pantene, we made sure we had a conceptual initiative on Head & Shoulders or all the other hair care brands that we had at that time. And same for detergents, and the same, if you had something on detergent, something big, we also had to have something on diapers or whatever the categories we were in at that time. And the second interventions we made was we started a top talent development program covering all levels in the organization, starting with a global survey among senior managers as to what they felt were gaps in the qualification of Japanese talents. And then based on that, we developed training programs addressing those gaps, and made sure that every senior executive, including myself, were teachers and were held accountable for developing these talents. And the next step was to, based on that, to set clear goals and make highly visible commitments. So, for example, we committed to the CEO at that time, H.E. Lafley, a goal of what we called 5x6. We wanted to have from zero, we wanted to have 5 Japanese general managers by 2006. And by 2006, we had actually then 6 general managers. And in a flat market, Japan delivered, I think it was 12 quarters, back-to-back quarters of double-digit volume and sales growth with obviously drastic profit improvements. So really, really penetrating the issue, identifying, isolating 2 or 3 key factors, and then having a very focused, targeted program to address them, and then making very public commitments as to desired goals.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you very much. Yeah, go ahead, Werner.
We had a when I then moved to Simia, we did a similar exercise, and Simia, Central Eastern Europe, Middle East, Africa, at that time had delivered average growth of 3 to 4%, which I felt was inadequate relative to the potential of the region. So we established a goal of growing the business every year by 15%. So from 3 to 4 to 15%. And we identified the roadblocks that had gotten in the way of delivering more sizable growth. We came up with a concept of granular building blocks, which each country had to apply and follow. And so have had a very systematic approach to delivering much bigger, much more sizable growth, and which we then actually did. Now, if I may elaborate on this question in a more general sense a little bit, I think making a difference as a leader always starts with asking the right questions versus just dictating right or wrong answers. So fundamentally, you need to be totally clear about whether you as a company or a team have the right to win from a, let's say, cost structure, portfolio, or even business model point of view. We also need to reassure ourselves that we have the ability to win. That is, for example, the skills to turn consumer insights into innovation and ultimately effective marketing and sales campaigns. And finally, do we have the willingness to win, which is all about aligning the organization, fleshing out overt disagreements with a proposed course of action. I mean, you wouldn't believe how often there's misalignment or tacit disagreement with certain priorities. And I would say, coming back to your question on what makes it so hard to lead consistently well, I would say that one factor is that we don't take enough time to honestly answer these 3 questions, and especially the one around willingness. Are we all aligned to invest in certain categories, in entering new businesses, and so forth? And that we rush too often to making commitments in order to please management. And those commitments all too often prove then to be unrealistically ambitious or even undeliverable. So I think spending a lot of time on answering those fundamental questions is, in my view, an art and a sign for good leadership. And yeah, if we have enough time, I would like to give you a few more examples about what I mean by asking the right questions versus giving answers. If that's okay with you.
Let's take one more, Werner.
Yeah. So the first, for example, when I was head of global operations, a key metric for customer service was case fill rate, which is the percent of cases we shipped versus what had been ordered. And we, P&G is at a very high level at about 96 or 97%. So an obvious answer, or an obvious question would have been, okay, so how can we move from 97 to 98 or 99%, right? But instead, I ask a different question, which is, what would it take for us to provide service that is so good that customers would want to tip us? And that led to a different...
What a great question.
Yeah.
I've never heard that in the consumer goods industry. What a great question.
Yeah, and so it led to a different concept, which is called SAMBC, service as measured by customers. So we interviewed all our major customers around the world, how they define service. And when we did that and measured our performance against their expectations, our service levels dropped to 40 or 50%. So we had to completely redefine our approach to customer service. And we wouldn't have done that if I had only asked, how do you move from 97 to 98%, but by asking a completely different, more fundamental question.
Awesome. Great example. Now, I love these examples, particularly the thorough analysis of performance and its drivers to the bottom, as you've alluded to in your Japanese example. I also love this attitude of taking a customer mindset rather than an inward-looking mindset. I've never heard this. Wow. I've never heard this perspective of serving a customer such that they would be ready to tip us. Mind-opening.
Not literally,
thought.
But metaphorically.
Yeah, metaphorically. Still, I love it. I've once heard, interestingly, from a Japanese consultant, from Tominaga-san in 2009, I heard a summary of customer service in just two words, listening to a lean management conference in Aachen. In the break, I went to him and said, Tominaga-san, can you just recap the essence of that term? And he said, he looked at my name tag and said, Homa-san. Bended forward and said, Homa-san, service quite simple. Honorable guest. Make sure your customer feels treated like an honorable guest, and then you nailed your customer service. Yeah,
and then they will tip you.
Yeah, that they will tip you. It's a similar concept of just in different words, of really serving customers rather than just looking for incremental steps forward. A breakthrough thought.
Sorry, that's what I mean with asking the right questions. It's easy for a leader to superficially address marginal issues like how to move from 97 to 98 or so in terms of case fill rate. But
yeah.
I think it's much more important that leaders really get to the bottom of the issues and stimulate new approaches, different solutions.
Yeah, very good. Now, a more challenging area of leadership, and you have had a tremendous career, Werner, and the numbers speak for themselves. But typically in most people's lives, success is not linear. It also contains setbacks, issues, trouble, tough leadership issues. Would you mind sharing with this LightWolf community out there a particularly tough leadership issue you had to face and how you solved it?
Yeah, I think my toughest leadership challenges centered around people issue. And I can give you a few examples. So for example, when I came to Churchill, the fine fragrance business that we had acquired in California, and I was moved over to run that business. But there was a CEO in place, and she was very sensitive to losing stature and the impact of me arriving on her standing in the external world, in Hollywood and Beverly Hills and you name it, right? So after some back and forth, I decided to volunteer that I would become the COO, report to her formally so she would save face and she could focus on the external world and I would run the business. Obviously, as a newly promoted general manager, it was painful for me, but it was the right thing to do. Then in Japan, I had a whole cadre of senior marketing directors with a seniority of 17, 18 years, which at that time, 20 years ago, was unusually long. Usually at P&G at that time, you became general manager after 12 to 15 years. And so these guys were solid, but clearly wouldn't be able to help us on the journey towards delivering breakthrough results and raising the next generation of Japanese leaders. And so as painful as it was, we had to separate from these people. And then I had one of my more senior leaders, a group president, who had a destructive impact on the organization and people, but who I had grown up with. And so I was hesitant to terminate him. Maybe my warm heart was too warm. And I think I made a huge mistake to spend too much time and on too many efforts and attempts to coach him. And so I wasted a lot of time, and ultimately the decision was inescapable, but I should have taken it much earlier. So what I'm saying is that issues and challenges around people are often much bigger, much more serious, and much harder to cope with than straight business challenges. At least that's my experience.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that example, that, as you call it yourself, that mistake, people mistake. It's interesting to see that many leaders with experience like you share people leadership issues as their biggest learning or as a mistake in hindsight. I rarely hear people saying, I separated from someone too early. I much more frequently hear people saying, I separated from someone too late. Now, if we drill into that individual, and please anonymous, I'm not interested in names or identities. I'm more interested in the topic. In hindsight, do you understand why that person, why that individual gave such a hard time on many around him, and whether there would be any way to make him change himself enough to be a better leader?
Yeah, that's a great question. If I had a straight answer, I would give it to you. But I suspect, even though this guy was intellectually superior, yeah, deep down, he probably suffered from an inferiority complex. And that's why he believed he always had to demonstrate that he was smarter and better than anyone else, that he could teach everyone a lesson, that what other people had to say was irrelevant, and that most people wouldn't get close to his intellectual standards. And I think it boiled down to a deep sense of insecurity or inferiority, if you wish, which is hard to detect. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but the fact of the matter is that I should have diagnosed the symptoms much better, much earlier, and should have taken ultimately corrective action without going through many circles of coaching and trying to eliminate that deficiency.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that very, very insightful lesson to learn for all of us. Now let's change topic. Let's zoom into the macro world. One of the nice things I saw a few months ago is that the first time, in that case, the United Bank of Switzerland, UBS, my own bank, has started to use good leadership as a criterion for investment decisions. And more advisory boards do establish leadership as a performance criterion for their management boards, because they believe, they are convinced, that strong leadership leads to stronger financial returns. Now, you yourself, Werner, you are in several boards. You hold several supervisory board roles yourself. What is your view on the role that supervisory boards should play in establishing the right leadership systems and the right leadership performance in their companies?
Well, in my view, this is a key responsibility of the board. And I say so because I believe that everything flows from having the right leaders and the right leadership systems in place, the strategies, the execution, the management of the cycle from goals to results and related adaptation and renewal. Also the governance around the how, the smell of the place that attracts and motivates top talents. A sound succession planning based on deep penetration of the organization and identification of top talents and their necessary and targeted development. I think that's the key responsibility of the board. And at PMI, where I'm on the board and where I am the chairman of the Compensation and Leadership Development Committee, I spend a lot of time with the HR manager, they call it People and Culture, or PNC, and his team outside board meetings. And you may know that PMI, Philip Morris International, is undergoing a major transformation towards replacing conventional cigarettes with reduced risk products. So mostly under the name IQOS. And this transformation requires totally new capabilities, more technology driven and more consumer focused. And it has led to doing an assessment, a very, very independent, thorough assessment of the company's top 300 managers against future leadership and functional skill requirements. It has also led to more regular, ongoing and instant feedback and related development programs. And it has led to the installation of personal NPS Net Promoter Scores for managers and leaders. And given the rapid change in required skills and know-how, it became also very clear very soon that PMI can't guarantee lifetime employment, which used to be the norm there, any longer. So the company needed to move from lifetime employment to lifetime employability, with all the supporting programs to deliver on that promise. So investing in skills that may not 100% necessary for succeeding at PMI, but that would equip people to succeed in a different environment should it come to separation. And I think that has been a very, very important element in retaining trust and loyalty of employees, even in these times of massive change. Importantly, we have a lot of inclusion metrics, not just ones that focus on measuring progress on diversity. And that is based on my insight that I have seen many highly diverse teams that didn't deliver high performance, but I have never seen a high performance team that wasn't diverse. But the key difference is inclusion, or fostering at least a climate of inclusive behavior that truly enables every employee to give their best. So I think I'm using all these examples to underline the point that I consider leadership development and leadership management the number one responsibility of a board.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, thank you very much, Werner. It's impressive to see also this concept of a personal net promoter score for managers and leaders. It's a tangible operational that the company walks the talk on developing leaders. Awesome. Now, sometimes people ask me, Stefan, aren't leaders charismatic, born? And my response is no, they are not born. Leaders are not born, but made. And leadership is lifelong learning. So, and I suspect it's similar for you, Werner. And then I bet it's interesting for our Lightwolf community to understand a bit what you do to develop yourself as a leader.
Yeah, I certainly wasn't born as a charismatic leader. So I think first of all, you have to practice it at every appropriate occasion, not just in business, obviously without becoming obnoxious, overbearing or besser vis-a-vis. But you also have to do a lot of reading and in order to stay on top of new trends and to benefit from new insights. I am personally participating regularly in related seminars and forums, for example, at IMD in Lausanne, which I think is one of the best management schools in the world, senior executive schools in the world, not only because I served on their board for 10 years. And very importantly, and one shouldn't underestimate the benefit and positive impact of positive effect of teaching the subject. Because when you teach something, you prepare, you really dive deep into the subject matter and you want to become an expert. So I just gave a presentation on leadership to the lead team of our distributor in the Near East and Africa. When I say our, it's P&G's old distributor, which I know from my active time in CIMEA.
Yeah.
And in January, I will give it to the lead team of one of my startups. So I try to stay fluent on it by teaching it. Then I try to enter new territories, like getting into politics or the startups that you mentioned before. I think both are other ways of making sure you don't stagnate or fall back. You get new insights and you pick up impulses from areas different from just the business. And I think vitally important for keeping the saw sharp longer term is that you renew and stay fit on all four dimensions of leadership relevant energy. And that includes the physical energy, the mental energy, emotional energy, and spiritual energy. It's nothing new that I'm telling you, but I understood the importance of not just focusing on business leadership and mental energy, but also in physical energy, emotional energy, and spiritual energy to stay fit and relevant. So that's what I would say in a nutshell is what I'm doing to develop myself as a leader and to stay relevant in the context, for example, of my board activities at Philip Morris and Goodyear.
Awesome. Great. Thank you very much for sharing this gold, Werner, for sharing all this experience on some profound questions, sharing some deep insights. I also love how you summarize your own self-development, including things like practice, teach, and entering new territories. I loved it. I'm sure the more than 20,000 people on this podcast will all have taken a little nugget and gotten some very good inspiration to think about their own impact on establishing the leadership around them that they want to see and feel. It was my honor. It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for your time, Werner, and thank you very much for sharing your lessons on leading to results.
Thank you, Stefan. It was a pleasure for me too. And I think it's also my responsibility to pass on as much of my experiences to the next generation. So I enjoyed doing it.
Awesome. In the name of the Lightwolf community, thank you very much, Werner Geisler.